are, everyone. Welcome back. Brand new Techish in the building. Woo-hoo. The first episode of 2021.
2021 vision.
Doesn't quite have the same ring to it.
It does not. It does not.
And for those of you hoping that this year would be better than last year, so far, not so good. Where do we begin? It's been quite uneventful. So I don't know what's going on.
Nothing has happened in the world, pop culture, tech, for us to talk about. Do you have a good time off, Mike? You have a good time?
Yeah, I've been chilling. It's been very relaxing watching the world go to hell.
I know. So, it's like, what day of January is it? Oh, it's only the 19th of January that we're recording this. This has been the longest 19 days ever.
Tell you what, I'm definitely not missing Trump on Twitter. That's that absolutely Ooh. Like.
Let's talk about that. Too little, too late. I mean, what did it take? It took the storming of the Capitol. They keep saying insurrection. I want to say coup. Because when it happens in Africa, we don't have these fancy words. We don't have these insurrection. You know, they'll come out and they'll be like, military coup in Nigeria. Coup, attempted revolution, blah, 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 blah. So let's use those dramatic words. It took a coup and what is supposed to be the largest free nation in the world for Twitter to finally do the thing we've been calling for. Many people have been calling for. And oh, great, Trump's finally banned. Oh my God, did you hear? Trump's been banned from Twitter. Ooh. For me, too little, too late. What are your opinions?
I think it is too little, too late, but I understand why they left it so late. Just primarily because now that he's coming out of office, there is no power of retribution. And I feel like they probably feared that if they banned him from Twitter, he would probably change some regulations. There's that Section 230 thing, which basically means that platforms like Twitter and Facebook are not liable to the content that's on their site. They're kind of seen as like platforms. Right. I think he might have gone in there and just like made life really difficult for them. But at the end of the day, they made a financial decision. I think they, you know, Twitter benefited from Trump on there. Using that platform as a megaphone.
Let's talk about that, because is that a values aligned decision or is that a commercial decision?
I think it's a combination of both. I think Twitter as a company is split. I think Jack Dorsey, well, let me cycle back. Twitter originally said that they were the free speech wing of the free speech party when they first started their company way back when. That's an actual direct quote from some of the early employees and founders there. And I think Jack Dorsey probably does come from that kind of libertarian strain of like philosophy of like free speech. And I think that's why he loves crypto so much. But I think the employees at Twitter are probably more similar to me and you, right? And they don't necessarily want to work at a company where they are amplifying the thoughts of, you know, bad people and people who are saying dumb shit that's hurtful now, right? And I think it just got to the point where it was like, this is too far. We can't even justify this to ourselves internally. And I think also the employees was like, I don't want to work at a company that's doing this.
Yeah.
The engineers have a lot of power now. It's similar to what we said. I don't think we talked about it, but, you know, we've heard about the Google union that started up now.
Oh, yes.
Still quite small, but you know what I mean? There's a lot now where there seems to be a movement where the engineers are realizing the power that they have, and they are one of the few individuals in the world whose skill set are so rare that they can have that leveraging power over their employers. And they're like, this is not the kind of company I want to work at. And there was rumors that a letter was sent to the senior executives at the company via the employee saying, we don't want to, this guy's got to go, basically, otherwise there's going to be strife within the company.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's multi-layers to this. I think the company is split. So Jack Dorsey came out later on with a Twitter thread basically being kind of like thoughtful, saying, we didn't want to do this. I really didn't want to have to do this. We don't want to be banning people, especially people who are basically like so important, quote unquote, in terms of the world, but we felt like we had no choice, blah, 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 and that, you know, going forward we're going to be a bit more measured and whatnot. So yeah, to me it's a bit of a shit show. I don't know what the ultimate motivation was, because like I said, Twitter stock was stagnant for a long time, and it kind of slowly has started to rise, like ever so slowly. And Trump's part of that. The fact that the most powerful person in the world is using that platform as a megaphone, to me, like, helps the company as a financial entity. What's the next step?
I just think this is such a great example of the lack of ethical consistency within our industry. And I think that is the pit that's the bit I want to unpack. Do you know what I'm saying? Because within the constraints of capitalism, we're always weighing this values-based decisions. You know, what do I feel is the right thing to do? What do I feel I should be doing with the commercial risk that's in the mix? And, you know, you mentioned, you know, Google staff unionizing. A lot of people who are participating in this union have come out on social media and said, you know, they felt that this was finally the time that they could do it, that there were enough people to do it, that they could participate without losing their jobs. You know, and it just really frustrates me that we have this like constant balancing act of, it's like, oh, I want to do the right thing, but how is that going to impact my material existence? If you're a CEO, how's that going to impact our share price, the board, etc.? Like, we just need a more ethical version of capitalism. That's like what I wanted to say straight off the bat. And, you know, this whole idea of like the bastion of free speech, I mean, we're going to go into hopefully Parler later as well, or Parlay. But I just feel like that is another conversation that has like matured enough that we now are able to draw the line between freedom of speech and then speech that's inciting violence, right? And we know since Trump came into office, the rise of racist attacks, the rise of Islamophobic attacks, like all of those things that he, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, you know, he has encouraged on their platform. And I just think one of the things that's been frustrating for me to watch is everyone getting on the anti-Trump bandwagon at this like inflection point. I was just like, I'm sorry, but it doesn't feel genuine, you know, like I just gotta be honest with that. It's a bit like, oh, so now you're anti him, huh? You anti him. Like, don't get me wrong, it's great that this permanent suspension kind of created this like deluge of like, I'm openly against it, I'm openly against it, I don't condone it, I don't condone it. But it's like, where you been at the last 4 years? Because when he called my country a shithole country on Twitter, that's the moment when I was like, okay, too far. But none of these folks were getting behind me then. So, yeah. So in terms of like what's next for me, it's kind of like we got to judge people not just by what they do, but when they do it.
You know what I wanted to ask you actually is I've heard some people say that we now need an internet bill of rights. Basically, what are your rights as an individual on the internet? Do you have some sort of right to have a platform on what essentially is now the public town square? So obviously freedom of speech was, the concept of freedom of speech was defined when, you know, you're allowed to go into the town square and shout your piece. Basically, we've got in Hyde Park, we've got Speaker's Corner where anyone can go and say whatever they want, basically, right?
Yeah.
Now these platforms have come about and now they've hit mass critical scale where essentially these are now the digital town square, right? There isn't any transparency about what the rules are, about whether you can be thrown off these platforms. And I say this not because I have any sympathy for Trump, but I do realize that those of us who are left-leaning on the left, at times, our perspective is demonized. Like if you were in the 70s and 80s and you were against the Vietnam War and you were pro the Black Panthers and you were pro Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, there's a very good chance that the mainstream would be like, we've got to get these people off the platform, man. We've got to throw these guys off because what they're saying is dangerous against the status quo. So should there be some kind of body that is above Facebook and Twitter that kind of says, or at least provides some sort of guidance about what the rules should be that can be applied evenly? Because now you've got people on the right saying, oh, they've thrown off Trump, so as soon as Biden becomes president, we've got to get him thrown off, or we've got to impeach. Like, should there be some sort of new rules for the new world? Or is it enough that Twitter can make the decision internally and like, and just be like, yo, this is our company, we're keeping it moving?
I mean, the issue with any sort of set of rules or guides is who's going to enforce it, right? And, you know, in this scenario, who do you think would be enforcing these internet user guide rules, guidelines? I mean,
the same people that enforce our other rights, essentially the government that we elect in theory, right? As in, I don't elect Twitter, I don't elect Jack Dorsey, right? But I do elect, theoretically speaking, my leaders, or I have a say about who I vote as my member of parliament or who you vote into the Senate if you're in the States. So should there be some sort of overarching legal framework now that is applicable to all of these platforms? Or is it enough to say Zuckerberg, Dorsey, whatever you feel like doing, whatever is in your whim? You know what I'm saying? And I don't say this out of sympathy for Trump. I say this out of the realization that those of us who have views that are also considered to be quite radical, like, for example, when Trump was in power, they were clamping down on pretty much the work that you do, which is basically inclusion and diversity, right?
They were saying, yes!
Right. So if Trump was in power for 8 years, and you had a weak leader at Twitter, maybe they might start muting, some of them words and say, oh, you can't really talk about this.
Blocking my account.
White supremacy, saying the phrase white supremacy now is racist, or saying the phrase, you know, white privilege by definition now is racist. Yeah. I've seen that said by one of the conservative members of parliament in the UK, in houses of parliament, oh, white supremacy or white privilege, these are racist concepts. So
I don't know. Well, I need to come to one of my workshops and learn why that's not possible. But anyway,
yeah. But so what is the map? What is the lay of the land like going forward?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes me feel uninspired about this idea of like, oh my gosh, we need clear guidelines on how to use the internet, we need internet user rights that organizations have to uphold and protect, is that it almost suggests that this is the internet's fault, you know, like, oh, it's like the internet's fault. It's not the internet's fault. Like, the internet is a utility. It's like blaming electricity or like water. It's like how we use it that then has like a greater societal impact. And I think for me, I'm very much of this mindset coming out of 2020 and all of the lessons that we learned, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's about systemic racism in the healthcare industry, whatever the discussion is, we need to think from the lens of systems. Like, you know, what's like the systemic change that is going to make us feel more connected and less divided and less polarized? And I don't think an internet user bill of rights is going to do anything to fix that. I think it's actually about coming back to the people and kind of like elevating consciousness. At the end of the day, all of the things that we do to make the internet more protected and more closed will just drive people to the dark web or other spaces. Like, you know, the dark web has already probably grown tons and tons and like will continue to. So I don't think that really like fixes anything. And it's more about us like trying to understand, why are these things happening on the internet? You know, why are people using these channels to manipulate people, you know, and turn people into, you know, puppets, unfortunately, you know, for their bidding, for their will. Like, at the end of the day, I think whatever, you know, Donald Trump's agenda is actually very self-interested and, you know, just driven by a need to have more attention, have more money, help his friends have more attention and more money. It's not the banner under which he operates. And, you know, that's been the case for so many dictators and autocrats in history. So, yeah, I would say if we're going to put our energy into something, let's put our energy into conversations with all of us, each other, and let's raise our consciousness because we have this opportunity to do that.
Interesting.
Okay, so I would like to talk about people living their best lives during the pandemic. I want to talk about people pivoting to new locations. I want to talk about people going on vacation, posting on Instagram, getting some hate. Before we dive into those tangential stories, I want to start with the story that really sparked it off. So Ania Williams, good friend of the podcast, was tweeting about a Clubhouse room, which was laying into this Black American woman who basically started this viral thread about moving to Bali during the pandemic. So, you know, many Black Americans have spent the last year kind of thinking about, is America the kind of country I want to live in? Is this the kind of place I want to be? So she goes into great detail about how she moved from, you know, an LA studio to this beautiful treehouse in Bali, fraction of the price. She talks about all of the benefits, low cost living, etc. And then she kind of like ends with this call to action to buy her ebook, which is basically going to help you circumvent some of the barriers that might make relocation difficult. And she faced a huge backlash for so many reasons. The fact that she really didn't call out the privilege that she had to even be able to do that in a year where a lot of people have been made redundant, put on furlough, ain't got no money. She didn't also call out the fact that there's like a bit of an ethical quandary around, like, you know, leaving one of like the countries with the highest cases of COVID to travel to a place that maybe doesn't have it. People also talked about, you know, this kind of idea of like, you know, gentrification. Like, do you actually know about Bali? A lot of people in Bali are living in poverty. You're kind of like coming there, flexing your vibes. Like, how is that any different to, you know, middle-class white Americans, like moving into Black neighborhoods in the US? So it really kind of just was like one of those things, how, you know, once you pull the string, it all starts unraveling. Now, I actually didn't join any of the Clubhouse rooms, but I kind of like caught all of it on Twitter. And I think it's really important for us to discuss this. And I really can't wait to hear your views, Michael. But, you know, putting, you know, the Bali thing at the center of this, there's been a lot of tension in the Black community across social media in general, because we also have folks, you know, let's say here in the UK, who have been traveling to Dubai, living their best life over there. One of my friends, Bam Bam Boogie, she runs Twerk After Work. She's currently in Mexico, in Tulum. She was posting stories of her celebrating her birthday. She was also posting screenshots of people saying, I'm unfollowing you, I'm unfollowing your business, because this is so unethical and this is so not okay. So tell me, Michael, having reflected on the whole Bali drama, relocate to Bali drama, what are your thoughts on all the hate that's out there right now?
You know, it's tough, because I'm not going to say I haven't contemplated ducking the UK and going somewhere. I've contemplated that, right? Same. But then obviously, and I think also, if the individual in question had just moved in silence and just lived their best life in Bali and never said nothing, I don't think...
Like a real G.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? What's that Lil Wayne line about?
Real G's moving in silence like lasagna.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, if he had done that, you know what? I think I don't know. I think once you open your public life, once you open your life to public discourse, be prepared for public discourse about what you're doing, right? And is there something immoral about what she's doing? Let's say, for example, you've tested negative, right? Mm-hmm. So on a safety level, let's talk about COVID. You tested negative before you've left and you've tested negative when you've landed. You are not basically spreading COVID, right? So you as an individual probably are not a risk in that sense. But if you're now encouraging a boatload of other people to come, which is what she was doing, trying to sell an ebook, that is not the same situation because now we don't know if everyone's going to be as careful as you. Now, are you impacting the locals? Bali is different than, for example, Dubai, which is kind of a rich area, whereas Bali has a lot of impoverished people. And if you're moving mm-hmm. in, taking all the kind of upper middle class areas, mm-hmm. then all of the upper middle class people in Bali now have to go to the middle class areas, and it goes down, and then the middle class people have to go to the poor areas, and then eventually the poor people are pushed out, and it's gentrification exactly. by another name, right? And do you know the struggle of people in Bali? Do you speak their language? You probably don't, right? So it's difficult. I think she probably shouldn't have just put her shit online and just kept it moving and been silent. That's what exactly. I would have done. I'm going to keep it real. And I wouldn't have sat there and encouraged everybody to do it. It's probably coming from a good place. It's like, listen, as a Black American woman, I've struggled in the US through actually being quite impoverished, the way she described it, unable to find work. Mm. And I found a better life. So I want to kind of get my people them and get them to have a better life.
But then right? the Indonesians were so hurt by that.
Yes, at whose expense? Exactly. You know what I'm saying? But there is an element where, like, I've seen people say, listen, Bali has essentially been Australia's playground for, like, however many... If you go to Bali, like, it's just a bunch of, like, drunk Australians just up in there doing their thing, right? And no one's really said shit. I mean, there has been, I'm sure, dialogue and, you know, conversation about that internally in the country. I don't know the exact details. I can't say there hasn't been. Mm. But it didn't seem as vocal as what I just saw here. Like, the backlash yeah. wasn't... And they did kind of team up on this woman. I don't know. This is not... There's not a straightforward answer. And
that's because I can see, like, you got Skyscanner up in the background.
No. I mean, listen, the UK, they just said that we've got the highest, you know, death rate globally. Like, this is a shit show. Like, this yeah. is actually, like, you know what I mean? This is actually, we are in a really bad place. Like, and if anyone could get out of here and escape, I ain't going to be mad at them. But there's so many things to consider. I don't know. What do you think? Like, what's the odd here?
This is the thing. It's so hard right now for me to even fathom this idea of 100,000 people dead from COVID in the UK. Yeah. What did my friend tell me the other day? Like, we've, like, lost more people in COVID than we did in, like, a world war. The UK has.
Yeah, absolutely. I can believe that.
And I was like, what? Because, you know, yeah, it's just, again, just so crazy and so hard to believe. But then at the same time, like I said, I go on Instagram and I see people living their best life. And I'm just like, wait, you traveled? Like, you put yourself at risk, not only of catching the virus, but also potentially being in, like, asymptomatic carrier. I don't know. You know, even the COVID tests, they're, like, 60% accurate. They're not, like, 99.9% accurate. So it's like, is a negative test enough for you to have that peace of mind that you're not going to another country? And, you know, when I was reading the responses to Kirsten, the ex-LA, now Bali lady's post, a lot of them were from people in Indonesia who were like, it's a pandemic. Our healthcare system is crumbling. How can you be encouraging people to come from the US and God knows where else here when this country can barely look after its own people right now? Like, and it was, for me, like, a really important reminder again of, like, why we have to recognize the privilege that we all have, because that was what made her whole thread and her book so tone deaf. Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like a mindful emigration or, like, wait until, you know, the WHO gives us the green light, wait until you have dose one of the vaccine. No, it was just like, I did it, you can do it too. And it was just that carelessness, which I really didn't like. And I think it's the same kind of thing right now where it's like, let's face it, like, we're all heightened sensitivity. We're going into, like, year two of an extended traumatic period of our lives. And I think people in positions of power, people with platforms, people with influence have to remember that people are looking to the content that they post on social media and the content that they create as, like, that one positive thing to look forward to, or that one aspirational thing to look forward to. And if this is how you make your money, and this is how you survive and how you promote yourself and how you get jobs, you can't be angry if suddenly you're acting in a reckless and irresponsible way that does not align with the values that you've been presenting to your audience, because you're now a product, right? Every influencer is a product. And unfortunately, the reality is you got to be consistent with how you're delivering that product. And if something doesn't align, i.e., I'm, you know, F the pandemic, off I go, then you just got to be willing to hear that feedback. You know what I'm saying? Because there are a lot of people out there who can escape. They can't do that. That's true. It's, do it in secret. Honestly, do it in secret. Just don't promote it.
You remember when Kim Kardashian had like her birthday and like she went to some island and I think she got all of her friends tested. So everyone was negative. And basically within that kind of bubble, everyone could behave as normal because everyone apparently tested negative. And people were saying, should she have posted this on Instagram? Essentially, when everyone else is locked down, you know, impoverished, struggling to find work, should she have posted such a luxurious event? I don't know what the answer is, because to a certain extent, there is a modicum of hateration, but it is also a modicum of like, people are struggling and what do you expect them to, what reaction do you expect from people?
Where's the community spirit in that? I'm sorry. Like, yeah. Let's just show me your suffering. That's what I need right now. Until I get my vaccination, like, we all need to be in this together. Screenshot your work from home space. Show me what Netflix show you're binging on. Show me what wine you're drinking to drown your sorrows. Like, that's the content that I need. And I think anything else is like, don't get me wrong. I know that people work hard. Like I said, I know that people work hard. And if you did the, you know, risk analysis, the cost benefit analysis, and you realized it was worth it for you to go, great. But when you start posting that, knowing that everybody else sat on their asses doing their moral duty, the government in the UK has literally said, stay your ass at home. Mm-hmm. And we're following those rules and you broke them. Don't be upset if people come for you.
Yeah, I think my final point on this is also like there are certain locations that people consider to be like restorative. Like, you know, you might say Bali, I can just go find myself. Mm. And I've heard people say that about certain African countries as well. Like, oh, Ghana is so restorative, I just come back. But it's like, we can't think of these places like as like some magical place. Exactly. Where like people don't live and exist the same way that we live and exist here. Do you know what I mean? And obviously if you're like somebody who's, you know, relatively quite oppressed in your home country, you don't think of the privilege of having that American passport, that British passport. And that puts you in a position above somebody who is stuck in the Bahamas or stuck in Bali. That's their home. That's not a place where it's not a getaway for them, right? So it's very complicated and very difficult. This episode is sponsored by Storage Lab. The team at Storage Lab is redefining the cloud storage industry with a decentralized platform built by a team spread over 10 countries, working together to lay the groundwork for Web 3.0 and a new era of decentralized online services. They are currently hiring on Pocket Jobs for a senior engineer and a DevOps cloud engineer. The company is based in Atlanta, but the positions are remote. Check the link in the show notes to apply. Peace.
I'm afraid to approach this next topic. I just want to put a disclaimer out there that I've been to Beijing, love China, great country, great food, great cinema, great culture, great tech, love TikTok. So I just want to put that out there because I want to make sure I can get a visa again.
I think after this story, you might be done. No, I'm joking. We'll tread carefully. So essentially, Jack Ma, who is the richest man in China, richest person in China, full stop, hasn't been seen in public for quite some time. He was on the verge of orchestrating one of the world's biggest IPOs. It's a company called Ant, which basically houses a company called Alipay, which is like one of the biggest payments platforms in China. My friend's Chinese and he tells me if you go to like China, you don't pay with cash, man. It's either Alipay or I think WeChat, you know, everything's QR coded up, everything. So a big company. And I think just before the company was about to IPO, he made a speech semi-critical of the financial system in China, essentially saying stuff like, you know, we have a pawn shop mentality. We need to level up, basically. The regulatory environment is too difficult. And since then, things have gone left for him. He hasn't been seen in public. Alibaba, his main company, where he built most of his wealth, is now being looked at by regulators in terms of being broken up or reduced in size. The IPO was blocked and stopped, and he hasn't been seen in however many months in public. He had a few public engagements that were cancelled. And I think the eyes of the world are thinking, rah, what's going on here? This is like somebody who is the darling of Western media. He was the face of Chinese capitalism. You know what I'm saying? Like, everyone knows Jack Ma. Like, I was going to read his book. I haven't got around to it. What do you think's happened to him? Like, do you think it's just like he's just hiding? They're like, let him lay low. like, don't get excited. Or is it something more nefarious? Like, I don't know.
I think it's just he's just been put on a media blackout because, you know, he used the media to criticize the Chinese government. And that's not cool. You know, there's a social contract in place, you know, and he broke it. And it, you know, this seems to kind of be a bit of a thread in this episode, this idea of like within our communities, like within the communities that we trust, the communities we're connected to, that we're a part of, what are those unspoken promises that we know keep us together and glue us together? And whether that's the global community of human beings fighting the pandemic and sticking to the rules of their government, being betrayed by the people breaking those rules, right, for their own, you know, personal benefit, or whether it's a case of, you know, a country like China, which, you know, let's face it, like most of us every time we think of China, it's through the lens of Western media, which is like highly critical of it for its own purpose, right? Like China is a rising superpower, a huge growing economy. It's a threat, basically. It's a threat. Unfortunately, we live in a world which sees it as a threat instead of seeing it as like a partner or someone who we could work with. But that's because of like, you know, different culture or different values, etc. But I, at first, you know, when I heard this story, I kind of defaulted to that like Western media lens single story, like, oh, don't fuck with China, because when you fuck with China, bad shit gonna happen to you. But then I was kind of like, hang on a minute, that's like my bias and my prejudice, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, Edward Snowden hasn't been able to go back to his home country after he fucked with the US government. You know, every country has the people that it's silenced or dismissed or excluded in some way. So yeah, I kind of think that while it's, you know, when our imaginations go mad, we can probably think like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, like, you know, what's happened? He's in one of those prisons. He's in this, he's in that. Like, I think the more true reality is he's just on a media blackout. He's just, you know, learning a lesson and he'll be back.
Yeah, I think this has happened before, actually. So there was one of the most famous actresses in China. She vanished from view for about 4 months, and then she came out basically with a post on social media, you know, showing her loyalty to the kind of government and paid a fine for tax evasion. So I think it is kind of a normal process. Not a normal process, but it is a process that they do normally, which is basically like, you got too big for your, you know, you got too big for your boots, like fall back, time out. But I think looking at things from the Western perspective can confuse you, because I was reading up on this, and apparently, so there's a company called Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. These are the three biggest companies in China. And now they're being investigated in terms of like their kind of monopoly power. And I was like, well, why? I always thought that China didn't have a problem with monopolies because they have like state monopolies. So, but because I was looking at it from the Western prism, I didn't necessarily realize that they would look at those companies the same way that we might look at Amazon, Facebook, and Google. Because I was like, I get why here we are like, well, we need to break these companies up because there's a history here of like, well, we want competition and we want smaller companies coming through. But I was under the impression that China didn't mind these kind of large state monopolies because the government has such a hand in controlling these companies.
Yeah.
It didn't make a difference, right? But that's because I have a biased perspective. I don't understand what's really going on the ground and the nuances of the situation. And even me and you speaking on this, like, we are not experts in, you know, China's economy or China's, you know, thing, you know, and we're looking at this as outsiders. I've never been there. I've got friends who are from there, but I don't know, you know, enough to understand what's really going down.
In other news, Issa Rae had her birthday the other day. Founder, creator, calling her a founder. I'm so techie. Can you call the creator of a show a founder? Anyway, whatever. Insecure. And they announced that the upcoming season 5, is going to be the last. I don't really have anything to say other than it's really bad. It's really bad. Michael's just silent.
You know what? I've never seen it. Yeah, I don't watch it. That's the thing.
I am so jealous of you right now that you get to experience it brand new.
You know what? The thing is, though, I don't, very rarely do I dive in and watch series anymore. Like, I wait to kind of, it's got that kind of, the consensus is there that like, it's a great show, because I've watched so many shows where it just ended up going shit, like Lost or like whatever in it. Like, and I've heard Game of Thrones was something similar. Like, I waited to the end of Game of Thrones before I thought about watching it. And then I heard that the final seasons were so terrible that I'm like,
didn't even start.
I'm not going to start this now, right? But if Insecure is solid from seasons 1 to 5, I will watch it. But I think I commend whenever somebody calls it a day at the right time. The last thing you want to do is have a show that's just dragging on seasons 10, you know, I was watching some of the later seasons of Friends, and it was like, yeah, guys, man, you kind of dragged this one on, guys. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know it was a payday, but come on. And I commend her. And she's probably going to go off and do movies. She's got a masterclass out recently, actually, as well.
I saw that. I was like, time to buy a masterclass.
You know what, though? I'm a subscriber of masterclass.
And are I you? Can you share your account?
Yeah, of course, but I haven't found it. I haven't found it that helpful, though, to be honest. Because the thing is, I feel like, for example, when I was learning to code, the person who I found most helpful was the person who was like 1 or 2 years ahead of me. So like, if you were like, because they understood what it was like to be a learner. And when I spoke to somebody who was like 10 years ahead of me, they couldn't put their mindset in the mind of a beginner. So some of these folks are so well established and so successful. It's like, how am I going to learn from Steph Curry how to shoot a basketball? Like, it just, there's no way I'm going into this as a beginner and ending up a Steph Curry. Like, I need somebody who's going to be like, yo, this is how you hold the ball. You know what I'm saying? And this is the way to, you know what I mean? And it's like, that's why I kind of found it like a bit not, I didn't find it that much value add, right? I mean, maybe Masterclass will never sponsor this podcast, but you know, if I do, I'll change my tune, innit?
That's useful feedback.
Feedback. This episode is also sponsored by Waymark. They are on a mission to make great video accessible to everyone by building powerful, intuitive products that make creative easy. They're currently hiring a pocket jobs for a remote senior software developer. If that sounds good to you, they'd love for you to apply, even if you live outside the Detroit area. Again, it's a remote position and the link is in the show notes. Peace.
I was going to ask you quickly, are you leaving WhatsApp? Are you going to go to Signal or Telegram, or are you just going to be happy with them keeping your data? Because I have had lots of friends who are not in tech be like, I want to know your opinion about, like, you know, should I stay on WhatsApp? And I was just like, the way I see it, I'm on Instagram, yeah, I'm on Messenger. Facebook already knows what it needs to know about me. So, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, they've got you. It's too late. Like,
they've got me.
Yeah, they've got you. And I think the problem with WhatsApp is why it was such a valuable company to purchase. It's just the network effects. Do you know what I'm saying? The reality is most people are not going to leave WhatsApp. Like, I've got family on WhatsApp. I've got my mom and dad on WhatsApp. Are they going to be like, Signal what? And what privacy what? Like, I think I never had the expectation that what I'm sending to somebody on WhatsApp is completely secure. I never had the expectation. Apart from anything that's in my mind or a face-to-face conversation, I don't consider it to be secure. If I'm texting it onto any kind of device, I consider it to be open for public consumption.
Exactly.
How many times have you seen people being like in a court case, oh, we've got their emails, let's have a look at their emails. And they're saying the worst kind of thing. And I'm like, yo, assume that your email is going to be open and read by anybody, right? Act accordingly. And I think the network effects of WhatsApp is just too strong. People are not going to leave. It's just the reality. I read the book called No Filter. I really recommend it. It's a book about the founding of Instagram and like the kind of problems that the Instagram founders had once they were in Facebook, when the values of the two companies didn't align. And there's a chapter on WhatsApp also about the founder who sold for $19 billion. And when he left, he realized, he was like, yo, like, I sold my soul to the devil. I'm leaving $1 billion on the table just out of stock equity that he could have cashed in if he just stayed for another year. And he wasn't willing to do so. Obviously, bearing in mind, he's already got tens of billions, so he's cool. But yeah, I think once Facebook made that acquisition, we all should have realized what time it was. I'm surprised they waited this long. I'm keeping it a buck. I'm surprised they waited this long.
That's true. I agree. Funnily enough, I have No Filter. I didn't finish reading it, so I'm going to finish reading it now. But yeah, like, as soon as the WhatsApp founders left, I mean, they hinted at this. So if y'all were paying attention, you should have known this is inevitability. To be honest, I assume that they were doing it anyway and just lying to us. I'm not going to lie. I just assumed that that was happening. So whatevs. All good.
I think I looked at the character of the founder, and also I'm going to keep it a buck. He's also from the Ukraine. And I feel like people that kind of come from those kind of societies that had a recent history of totalitarian governments and they're not the too distant past are probably more inclined to be like, we need to protect people's speech versus someone like, you know, Mark, who's just always for open transparency, you know, connecting the world, right? So you've got to kind of look at what is the kind of spirit and character of the company, right? But yeah, I assumed it was always open. I never assumed there was privacy. I think everybody, whatever you're messaging, just know that eventually it probably will be for public consumption. Don't send that into mad. Yeah,
I don't want the world to know. Burn it.
And also, to be honest, until that day that Elon puts those chips on our heads, your brain is the only safe place, right? And then when that day comes, when they put that chip in your head, then it's a thing. And you know what? I'm not going to lie. I think in 100 years' time, everybody will have that chip in their head.
100 years? Dude, talk about like 17 years. That's quicker than that. No, go read Ray Kurzweil's predictions about the future and singularity. It's going to happen a lot sooner.
Because all that's going to happen is you're going to see somebody move something with their mind and you're going to be like, oh, hell no, I need that. You're going to be like, I need that chip.
You're not in that Neuralink beta. Let me send you an invite, bro.
As soon as I see some telekinesis, I'm like, I need that chip in my head. That's it. We're done. This is what I want.
Entering the Marvel universe.
Basically. All right, cool, everyone. That's been this week's Techish. Yo, and I want to read out some dope reviews. Someone said, informative and funny. Listening to Michael and Abadesi is easy to keep up with the biggest tech stories of the week. A very enjoyable listen. And that's from Vivian Nyong via Apple Podcasts, Great Britain. I think the informative is you and the funny part is me. So we're going to move on from there.
See what my next Twitter poll will be.
Everyone, yeah, thanks for listening. Hashtag Techish. Oh, also, we've got our own socials. So we've got Techish Pod on Twitter.
Techish Pod
on Instagram. The link will be in the bio. Give us a follow if you want a dedicated social media feed. Techish. And we'll catch you next week. Peace.
See you there. Bye.
Ciao.